Bet365 sponsors the Red Agenda, the Liverpool podcast brought to you by The Athletic, and they feature over 300,000 sporting events on their betting app. It's got everything you need to bet on sport. The domestic season returns next weekend with the Community Shield, and Bet365 are offering a wide range of markets, including first, last or anytime goal scorers. With over 45 million members, it's the world's favourite online betting company. With the Bet365 Bet Builder, you can combine match results, players to score, number of goals and more, and create your own personalised bet. And if you can't watch the games live, with Bet365's Match Live feature, you can follow every moment through live graphics and text. Bet365, it's the world's favourite online sport betting company. The app can be downloaded from Google Play and Apple App Store. Over 18s only. Please gamble responsibly.
Jordan, you're a great professional. Well, tell me you're going to get absolutely rotten tonight, like me.
Possibly.
Come on, Jordan, go for it, lad. Enjoy yourself.
Cheers, Cara.
It's another Red Agenda, your Liverpool FC podcast exclusive to The Athletic. I'm Steve Hothersall, joined as always by one of our top writers, Simon Hughes. Welcome, Si.
Hi, Steve. You okay?
Yeah, great, thank you. And we have a special guest today who's going to give us a great insight into what it takes to make that giant leap from Liverpool's academy to the first team. 4 years in the Reds' first team between 1996 and 2000. He's now carving a path into management with Radcliffe Borough in the Northern Premier League. Former Liverpool midfielder David Thompson. Tomo, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Make me sound half decent with that introduction there.
It's great to have you. I'm sort of interested. Is pre-season better being in management than a player? Which is more grueling? Because obviously you're going through it at the moment in the managerial capacity.
Well, I'm only assistant manager at the moment. I'm actually joining in most of the pre-season. I mean, I've got a little bit of a weight to shift. Obviously, been on that lockdown diet, like most of us have. So I've joined in as much as I can with the boys, but I enjoyed it more as a player. I mean, it was a really tough, grueling period to go through, but one that was necessary. But I always noticed that when I completed pre-season, if you hadn't got any injuries, you've got through to the other side and you've made it, you get a few friendlies under your belt, then when you look back at the end of the season, they're your best seasons, they're your most constructive seasons. And I think many pros, the likes of Mark Wright and, funny enough, Neil Ruddock as well, saying, you know, when you get through pre-season, it's important that you've got to get through it and not get any injuries, because it does have a knock-on effect. You're sort of chasing your tail, so to speak. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it as assistant manager, but I do miss it. I really do miss it. It was a fantastic period.
I'm absolutely delighted to see you back in the game, as I'm sure Si is as well. We both know you, Si. He's got so much to offer, hasn't he? What do you immediately think of when you think of Tomo?
Well, I think of the player first and foremost. I mean, I remember when I was sort of, I must have been in my mid to late teens when Tomo broke into the first team, and it was his enthusiasm, I think, that jumped out, and is obviously technical ability as well. Like, I just remember being inside Anfield, and everybody was, sometimes with local players, it's a bit weird. I think we've sort of gone full circle. I think the late 90s, it was quite a difficult period to be a local player getting into the first team at Liverpool, because before Tomo had broken in, obviously they'd had Robbie Fowler and quite a number of young players, and it hadn't quite clicked into a period of success. They didn't quite get to where they wanted to be. And I remember sort of the feeling inside Anfield being one of frustration, really. You know, there wasn't that sort of love for the local players that we have now, because there's so few of them. So it was difficult to go in and impress. And I just always remember that despite all this, I think Tomo was like sort of really, really liked by even like some of the owners that I sat nearby. So, because I think they could see how much he wanted it, you know what I mean? And so that's what I think of as well. I also think of him scoring for Coventry against Liverpool and running over to Gerard Houllier and telling him what he thought.
Fond memories, eh, Tomo?
It is fond memories. I mean, I've had to apologise a couple of times via my Instagram for, you know, obviously when you go and play against your former club, you always say, I won't celebrate, but that goal was so good. I mean, I caught it so sweet. So I didn't intend to celebrate, and obviously I wanted to be very respectful. And up until that point, you know, I got a great welcome from the Liverpool fans. But after that, it was like booing me, giving me a load of stick. So, yeah, but I have apologised to Gerrard since then.
It leads us quite nicely into the mindset of players. So let's talk about, Simon mentioned there, that idea of there could be some sort of disgruntled fans, some who liked a good moan. How aware of you when you're young, Tomo, are you that you have to make an immediate impression, particularly when you're coming from the Liverpool Academy?
Very aware, really. Especially, I mean, we've all been in the stadium as fans. You know, you can feel the weight of expectation with every pass. You can feel it building. You can feel the crowd getting excited. And when one goes astray, the whole stadium just lets out a huge sigh, and it's like disappointment. So you can feel that, and you take that expectation onto the pitch, and you know, you've just got to remember to do the right things, what have got you there, and remember that you've got to put the team needs before your own. So you're not out there to try and show how many Cruyff turns you can do. It's just that you know, you're trying to do a job for the team and try and keep possession and move and play the Liverpool way, really. And, you know, I remember getting in. You've always got Ronnie Moran in your ear, just reminding you of the things that you needed to do correctly.
Absolutely. And look, you were surrounded by some terrific players when you were at the Academy, of course, and you won the Youth Cup with Michael Owen and Jamie Carragher. Was there a certain mindset that you all had that was controlled by the management team above you?
I think it's the standards. I mean, you become institutionalised, Steve, especially when you've been at Liverpool for such a long time. Obviously, winning is everything, but doing it the right way. You know, this is why I feel disappointment when I look back on my career. You know, to always felt like a winner when I was at Liverpool, always felt like I'd have that winning mentality. And, you know, I'd get upset if I lost five a-sides in training on a Wednesday or a Thursday, you know, and, you know, that type of thing. But looking back on my career, I see it as a bit of disappointment. I never had anything to show for it. But, you know, if you look at Liverpool is all about winning. And, you know, it's been carried forward for generations. You look back in the history of Liverpool Football Club, it's all about winning. So very disappointed in my career to look back and not feel like a winner, even though I still hold myself as a winner, have that winning mentality, but it just never materialised.
I mean, to play in the Premier League is an achievement itself. Si, it's interesting, isn't it, hearing Tomo talk about himself and say he doesn't categorise himself as a winner.
Yeah. I mean, I've obviously interviewed Tomo a few times. The first time was for a book that I did a few years ago, and you know, and I know he's here now, and it feels a bit weird talking about him like this. But he he's very introspective about his own sort of achievements in the game, and sort of where he stands, I suppose. And I mean, I can understand the way he feels, but you know, I still don't think it should take away from the fact that he was going into Liverpool at a very, you know, changing time in Liverpool's history. I mean, you think about like sort of what Gerard Houllier did at that point. I mean, it was a revolution, really. You know, that sort of happened over a period of 18 months, where Liverpool went from being sort of a team which had, you know, it was known for its attacking capacity, to a team that became very, very solid and quite rigid. And I remember obviously speaking to Tomo about that, and how, you know, he was almost, you know, you mentioned that word institutionalised there, about how you grow up through the Liverpool system and learn to play a certain way. But then when you get into the first team under a different sort of manager with a different ideas, who wants to take the team and the club in a different direction, he had to then tailor his sort of style and performance to what he wanted. So it was a big shift, I think, and maybe he was caught a bit unfortunately at that time. I know it worked for some players. Obviously, for Jamie Carragher, you know, he loved Houllier. You know, and obviously Steven Gerrard sort of rose into the team under his management. But I can understand, listening to Tomo, why he feels differently about it. I mean, it'd be good to maybe just hear from Tomo there about sort of how it worked out with Houllier, because I think there's sort of some parallels to now with some of the younger players, somebody like Curtis Jones, who's obviously doing well for the first team. He's made his mark last season, scored some important goals. But it's quite clear, you know, that he has to become a Klopp player before he's going to play, you know, regularly. There's some parallels there, I think, in terms of the talent, personality, you know, desire. I mean, I don't know whether you see it that way, Tomo.
No, the way I look at it, and I know Cara and Stevie, they hold, and Danny Murphy as well, they hold Gerrard in high regard. I think in terms of player development, I think he brought a lot of discipline and a lot of a real good culture to the club. That was needed, by the way. It was needed. I have no problem with that. I think what helps them really, you know, hold Gerrard in high regard is the fact that they won trophies and they've got, you know, something to show for that. I think if you look at Carragher's period, his best development years, obviously he was maturing as a player, but his best development years was under Rafa. I think the coaching that he was receiving then and his understanding of the game went on to another level under Rafa. So, you know, in terms of team shape and team balance, Gerrard was great in getting that discipline. But in terms of player development, I think he was a little bit, not primitive, but I don't think he was tactically fantastic. Not for me anyway. But, you know, when I look back at that period, it is one of frustration. And I think you're seeing the frustration because I never wanted to leave Liverpool, really. I just felt like I had to. And it, at the end of the day, it was my choice to leave. You know, me and Gerrard had that opportunity. We had the discussion. He offered me a contract. I don't think the contract was reflective of how much he wanted to keep me. And the season before, you know, being pulled off when I was having great games and really enjoying myself, I just, you know, I never noticed the change in the times, really. He was probably bringing me off, trying to look after me and you know, nurture the young talent rather than when we were kids. Anyone who got brought off was because they were having, they were the worst player on the pitch. So I had that mentality and I was pulling a face. And, you know, I just wish I was a little bit more mature at the time to be able to maybe hang around a little bit longer and maybe I'd have something to show for my career.
I mean, one of your great attributes is your confidence, but perhaps at that early age, were you too confident or too... you felt your own opinion was the only opinion?
Yeah, possibly. I was very headstrong, but I had full confidence in my ability to go and be able to display wherever I was going to play. You know, I didn't intend to really sign for Coventry. It was just that when I met with Gordon Strachan, you know, he just made me feel $1 million. And you know, when someone wants to, you know, supposedly build a team around you and play you in the position that you want to play, you know, you're going to give it a chance. And I thought to myself, I'll go down there and I'll just display what I can do in the Premier League, and then obviously I'll bounce back to a club that I feel is my level. It didn't quite work out that way. I had to stay another season, play in the Championship, but you know, I got to where I felt like there was a really good level to play at, and I was just beginning to show the ability that I always knew I'd had for that two seasons at Blackburn.
You were talking before about the periods where players grow. So you mentioned Carragher's greatest growth was under Rafa Benitez. You might cite yours as a different period within your life. I'd be interested to know where the academy fits in making you as a player. How big a percentage is that in making you as a player? Or how much is it based on the individual themselves? If we look now at perhaps a Curtis Jones.
I would say the academy coaching that I received at the time was absolutely second to none. It really was. When I say it was an institution, it was day in, day out, every game, every training session. The standards were so high. If you didn't conform, you know, you were out. But the education that you received, but not just in terms of football, but in terms of, you know, developing as a human being. I think Steve Highway was there, and you know, with this, he was always there to remind you of the standards and the club that you were representing. You know, it wasn't just representing yourself. At every opportunity, you were representing Liverpool Football Club, and you was always reminded of that. But the standards in training were so high, you know, the understanding, the tactics that were always being displayed in training was just, it was absolutely ridiculous. And you know, second to none throughout the country. I think Man United were a close second at the time. But in terms of, you know, the buying into the Klopp way, and you have got to, you see the way they play and the way they tactically, you've got to fit into that system. And I think this is where it's going to be difficult for Curtis Jones this year, because I think he's caught between the devil and the deep blue sea there. He's not, maybe not quite an out-and-out attacker, and maybe he's not quite your box-to-box midfielder. It's going to be difficult. So, yeah, he's going to have to make his mind up this year and see where he fits in and choose that position and try to develop himself to fit that team, and that's where he's going to get a game.
So, Si, does he make that decision himself, or is he influenced?
No, I mean, I think it starts with the manager, isn't it? I mean, the manager picks the team, the manager... you know, he's played players out of position, you know, far more experienced players. It's quite clear, you know, James Milner hated playing left back, did a job for a year, and then obviously Liverpool signed Andy Robertson and he was back playing in midfield. I mean, I think, you know, obviously there's an open dialogue between Klopp and the players, and that they'll have the chance to tell the manager what they think about their place and their standing in the team. But it'll ultimately be his decision. I mean, he's the one who's watching everything on the training ground and seeing how they fit in. And I mean, I saw the friendly match against Stuttgart the other day, and Curtis Jones came back. He looked bigger and stronger. I think he's got really powerful lower body strength. You could notice that last season, but it seems like he's been working on his upper body as well. So he's, you know, he's a big unit for a lad who's still, he's still a teenager. I mean, I think that sets him in good stead. He's obviously got that bit of spike about him, that belief, and he's got, I think he's still developing sort of a tactical appreciation for what the manager wants, but he's heading in the right direction. I mean, I remember sort of talking about him 2 or 3 years ago. Everybody at the academy sort of just loved everything about him. It was just, could he sort of, you know, make that mental leap, I guess, you know, into becoming an adult, you know, both physically and mentally. And I think, you know, you saw that after one of the games last season when he gave an interview after the game and he was talking about just his desperation to play. I think that sort of the team understands, you know, that's the way he thinks. And I think Klopp likes that about him, the fact that he sort of, it's not arrogance, it's just a confidence in his own ability and a, you know, a will to play. A bit similar to Tomo, I think they're just sort of desperate to sort of make his mark. And, you know, when he plays and gets taken off, which has happened a couple of times, it's not because he's the worst player, it's because the manager's trying to look after him. So it will be interesting, because I think everybody sort of wants to see him do well. You know, to score a goal, the goal that he scored against Everton in the FA Cup third round, you know, to do that at that age, you've got to have something about you. You know, he's put it in the top corner. And
he's been doing that at the academy for years, though, hasn't he? Yeah, I mean, we've seen him do that, you know, many, many times down at Kirby. Yeah. He's got fantastic ability. He's got decent pace. I wouldn't say he's lightning quick, but he's got decent pace. And it's like you've just said there, Simon, he's filling out a bit, and he's growing into his man's body now. But the same problems I saw at the academy, I'm seeing now. I don't know if he is, like, you know, is he your Jordan Henderson? Is he your Genie Wijnaldum? Or is he your Sadio Mane? Or is he your Mo Salah? I think he's that good at both areas, really. So it's trying to find out, pinpoint where you can put him in, what position is going to suit him best. But no doubt the kid's got ability, and he's got confidence there, and he's got a desire to do so well at Liverpool Football Club. And, you know, it's... Let's be honest, he's at one of the hardest clubs to break into in world football.
Oh, exactly. I mean, he's learning the game at the very highest level. You know, like, you know, obviously Liverpool aren't European champions anymore, but they were when he came into the team, and, you know, they're obviously the English champions now. I mean, the task couldn't be any greater. But, I mean, I think, you know, they've obviously let Adam Lallana go for a reason. I mean, Adam Lallana, obviously, when he first played for Liverpool, he was more sort of left-sided. But under Klopp, he's played more in the centre. I suspect that Klopp sees that is his future sort of number 8 or sort of number 10 position. Because he has got good feet as well around the, you know, sort of around the box. You know, he's very quick, isn't he? So he really excites me. I think he's a really exciting player. You know, he's a bit different to what sort of we've seen come through the academy over the years. I think if there's one criticism of the academy, sometimes when the players come into the team, you don't see like that sort of raw personality. And I think for some people, it might rub some fans up the wrong way. But for me, it excites me. I'd rather see a player who wants to back himself, but is sensible enough to sort of know how to act around the training ground. And I think that is the one big thing. He wouldn't be getting chances that he's getting if he wasn't training to the level that Klopp wants. And that's the big thing. If you can train with that team, if you can't train with that team, you've got no chance. And he's obviously training to a very high standard. So
he's got so much raw ability. He's got a really high work rate as well. The only problem I can see with him trying to get a game at Liverpool or a regular game, it's just where can he fit in tactically? You know, is he going to be in that midfield? Because that midfield is high energy. You know, they cover up to 13 kilometres a game. You know, they're making tackles, they're giving the ball to the front three. in the front three, you look at Sadio Mane, you've got them, him and Mo Salah, who push the space in behind, allow Firmino to come to the ball. It's just trying to get him. We're just trying to find out his role, really. They're only going to find that out by playing him, really. I'm excited by it, and it's a challenge for him, and it's a great challenge. But there's no doubt, with his ability, he's got potential to be a Liverpool player. It's just trying to find out where he fits in tactically, and can he get the chances and take him.
Right, this is the Red Agenda on The Athletic. Thank you for joining us today. Special guest today is David Thompson. Simon Hughes here as always. Don't forget, on The Athletic right now, loads of great writing on Liverpool, including the Premier League 60 series. It's already included a number of current and ex-Liverpool stars like Luis Suarez, Robbie Fowler, and Mo Salah. So if you just head to theathletic.com/Liverpool pod, sign up for a 30-day free trial. That's theathletic.com/Liverpool pod. So, pre-season is up and running. Domestic season, less than 3 weeks away. And only two more friendlies scheduled at the moment. We've got Salzburg on Tuesday and the Community Shield. But let's reflect on the first pre-season game. That's the 3-0 win over the Bundesliga side Stuttgart. With so few pre-season games, does it change entirely the complexity of what you'd normally do to the situation Liverpool are currently in, Tomo?
You know what? They must feel a bit strange at the moment, because you don't know if it's pre-season or the start of the season now. I mean, where are we now? The end of August. We should be three games in at least, shouldn't we?
Yeah, it's crazy really, isn't it? Does that play with their mindset, do you think?
I definitely think it does. You know, I bumped into Michael Edwards yesterday and we were talking about this. You know, really, we should be, you know, three or four games into the season already by now. So the lads are, you know, it must be a bit strange for the lads. But
where did you bump into Michael Edwards? You've got to tell us more about this.
Well, obviously I live up Manchester ways, don't I? So I was walking down the street and I've known Michael Edwards since our Portsmouth days. He was he was the data analysis guy under Harry Redknapp. And I had a great relationship with him then. But we lost touch for a number of years, and we were walking down the street and he sort of just came up to me and stopped me. He said, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I went, "I do, but you've changed your hair so much." I said, "That's why I was looking at you, and like, you know, do I know that guy or do I not know that guy?" And so we had a good chat, and interesting, very interesting, mate. So Liverpool's an exciting time at the minute. He's done an amazing job. Absolutely amazing job, and I think a lot of the credit, obviously, that Jurgen Klopp gets, when you look at the signings that Michael's made, and he's always been this type of guy, because we made some fantastic signings when we were down at Portsmouth. He's doing a fantastic job, and it is an exciting time, and one that's only going to get better for Liverpool Football Club. The only problem that is is hindering Liverpool at the moment is this pandemic has come just at a really, really bad time for anyone, but particularly Liverpool, because when we were on the cusp of, you know, expanding the global brand and expanding the income, you know, obviously this pandemic's hit Liverpool's balance sheet very hard.
Tomo, he is the sort of person that likes to stay behind the scenes, isn't he? Give us some sort of idea about Michael Edwards, because we hear the name a lot, but you never see him, do you? Never hear him talking. Does that just fit the man himself?
Eddie is a great guy. He's one of the lads. He loves to have a crack and a joke, and he loves to obviously take the mickey. But he's always been very, very studious about his job. You could ask him about any footballer throughout world football. He'd know all about him. Obviously, I cracked a joke yesterday about... I tried to ask him about Thiago. Are we signing Thiago? He wasn't very forthcoming about it. But when I said I actually man-marked his dad, I said, Mazzino, when he played for Celta Vigo, you know, I did feel really old at that point.
You know, what a player he was as well, Mazzino.
Oh, I couldn't get near him. I'm still trying to find him now. You know what? We're talking about Gerard Houllier being tactically astute. He was, because obviously he identified Mazzino as being a really dangerous player. But he never told me actually how good he was. I mean, I'd not really heard of him. Obviously, I'd seen him play in the 94 World Cup, but I'd never really heard of him. He was quite under the radar a little bit with Bebeto and Romario playing up front. And, you know, for me to go and then man Mark Mazzino, I'm still trying to find him.
Anyway, you went off tack there. You were talking about Michael Edwards. He's got this ridiculous knowledge, has he, of players across the world?
Absolutely, yeah. Very studious and also, you know, very, very particular. Knows his football inside out. He's a great guy, really charming guy, got great charisma, and you can see why him and Jurgen Klopp have got a great relationship.
I was just thinking of the last ex-Liverpool player, or Liverpool associate who I bumped into. It was John Barnes in Tesco. What about you, Si?
I suppose I live in Crosby, so Canada's around here, so I bumped into him in the sandwich shop at the bottom end of my road a couple of weeks ago. He's always getting soup.
It doesn't spark conversations about Thiago. Let's go to Thiago.
Hang on, Canada's always getting soup, is he?
Yeah, it seems like he always seems to be ordering soup. Soup of the day, yeah.
Soup and tea bags.
You asked Michael Edwards about Thiago. He didn't give an answer.
No, he didn't.
We all watched the Champions League final, and Bayern season's come to a close. They've joined that exclusive six times club. But will they lose Thiago, one of their key components? Again, he looked phenomenal, side, didn't he, in that final?
I love watching him play. I mean, I think it's quite interesting, really, you know, what we see a player develop. I remember, obviously, when he was at Barcelona, he obviously immensely talented, and then Guardiola took him to Bayern, and you know he was going to be a key player there. But I think now he's obviously in his late 20s, he's got that experience as well, and he just never gives the ball away, does he? Never gives the ball away, and he's always there. You know, there's a challenge to be won. He's always agitating to win the ball back. So you can see why. You can see why Liverpool would be very interested in him.
It looks like he'd fit into that Liverpool team absolutely very, very well. He's like a shoo-in, isn't he? He's that type of player, high energy, high tempo. He can switch the ball from left to right. He can penetrate, you know, opposition midfield. He can take about six players out the game with one pass. But, yeah, hopefully we could sign him, but it's... Whose place is he going to take? Because we've got some, you know, very talented midfielders in there. I think Fabinho was ridiculous last year. Wijnaldum is one of my favourite players. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen him give the ball away in the whole time he's been at Liverpool Football Club. And then you've got Jordan.
And Naby Keita's making a new statement for his place as well.
Yeah, you've got Naby in there. I think Naby... He's obviously needs to come up to speed. I don't know whether his body can cope with the demands of Premier League football. At the minute, he's showing signs that he can't. There's no doubt about his ability. He's a really technically gifted player. But Thiago would just... I would love to see him at Liverpool Football Club, to be honest.
I mean, if you're selling it to a Thiago, he has to know that he's going to be constantly involved, doesn't he? He's 29. If he's going to move away,
he's not coming as a squad player, is he?
No, he's not, is he? the all-round midfielder. I heard Didi Haman saying he'd be surprised if he didn't sign for Liverpool.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had a little bit of dialogue with a few people this morning, and you know, the sort of sounds coming out of Bayern Munich is that they expect him to go to Liverpool, but equally, Liverpool haven't made the offer yet. So. So yeah, that's pretty much where they're up to. I mean, I think you know, we've spoken about it before, haven't we? That, you know, sort of Liverpool. I think there's a lot of things to consider. That, you know, primarily, you know, obviously, Tomo's just touched on the balance sheet there. That they want to make sure that they've got the right funding in place. I mean, I think a few players are obviously going to have to leave. I mean, some players we didn't even mention there. You know, Oxlade-Chamberlain trying to get into the team. Even Marco Grujic, you know, a player who has done well, you know, in the Bundesliga. I think if Thiago were to come, I can't see where he gets a game at all. And, you know, he's getting to an age now where he probably needs to play and be the main man in the middle there. So, you know, it's an area of the pitch where Liverpool have got unbelievable options already. But I've got to say, I mean, I think he would bring something different that they don't have. So we will see. I mean, Liverpool, obviously, sort of waiting to see whether they can get there, all their sort of things in order.
Would you see him playing in Fabinho's position?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Fabinho, to me, I mean, if you look at the way Klopp picks the team, he's always, in the big games, he's always the main one in the middle of the three, isn't he? So I mean, few people have spoken about him dropping back defensively. You know, might not need to go and sign a centre half, but I think he'd lose a lot really if he wasn't there. I just think that the amount of possession that he wins, I think his form sort of improved. Well, it did improve. I think having been out for such a long time, when he after lockdown, you could see those first few games he was right at it. I mean, I think he's the one who is undroppable. I mean, ultimately, Wijnaldum at the moment, his contract is up within a year. I think that must be causing a fair amount of anxiety why that hasn't happened. And he's, as you say, I agree with you, Tomo. I think he's a brilliant footballer, absolutely brilliant. You'd be absolutely loath to lose him, but I suppose you've got to be prepared for the fact that he might go. I mean, he must be assessing his options now. It's a tricky.
But if you look at, you know, Koeman taking over at Barcelona, you know, he's a player there would obviously he's worked with Wijnaldum over the last 18 months, and he's been. His form for Holland has been absolutely exceptional, so I could see that being an option.
Yeah. He scores a lot of goals for Holland as well. I think every time I seem to watch Holland, he's always scoring goals. So it's clearly, you know, Koeman.
He's got about 10 goals in 20 games for Holland, hasn't he?
So clearly, Koeman knows his game well, it evidently wants to play him a bit higher up the pitch in a slightly different way. So maybe you might be right. I mean, I guess I'm being speculative a bit there, but it would make sense, you know.
I would see Thiago playing in the Fabinho role. I just think he can dictate the tempo of the game better. Obviously, Fabinho's there to break up the play and give it to the players up front to do the damage. But when you've got a player like Thiago in there, yeah, he can do the tackle. Yeah, he brings energy, but he can break the lines and also dictate the tempo of the game, which he did tremendously well yesterday.
So, Tom, are you talking about moving Fabinho in the side or putting him on the bench? Because effectively, when he's at the top of his game, he is arguably Liverpool's man for many of the big fixtures.
He is, but I think, you know, if you were going to ask me about Thiago or Fabinho, as much as I really, really rate Fabinho, I think I'd have to go for Thiago. It's a really difficult situation. And also, when you look at the price, I think if he's coming in at like €29 million, I think that's a no-brainer, really. It's an absolutely no-brainer. And if you can generate some funds by letting some other the fringe players go, you know, the likes of you, you know, you could even look at Ox, couldn't you? It's scary, isn't it? You know, players that have done well and still bringing something to the team. You're talking about offsetting them to generate some funds. But this is what it's about now. When you're top of the tree, you've got to make continual improvements. You know, it's not a sideways step bringing Thiago in. It's a forward step.
Right, this is the Red Agenda on The Athletic, and it's brought to you by Manscaped, the expert in men's below the belt grooming. You're not hearing things, Tomo. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. And Manscaped has just launched in the UK. 10 years? We've gone years. Sorry, let me start that again. We've gone years without using the right tools for the job. So you can be one of the first men in the country to experience Manscaped life-changing products. Have you bought into this, Tomo?
No. I've been manscaping for years, me pal.
Actually, he does look precision engineered, as Tomo. They've got a third generation trimmer which features a cutting edge ceramic blade to reduce manscaping accidents, and there's water resistant technology, allowing you to groom in the shower. A special offer right now for all of you listening to the podcast. I wonder what the lads at Radcliffe Borough would say about this one in the changing rooms. You get 20% off and free shipping by using the code EPL20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com using the code EPL20. Happy shaving. You don't know what to say now, do you, Tomo?
No, you've ruined it now. We should call it a day now.
Let's go to play. Just mentioned them because I want to link it into perhaps your own experiences. You're talking about Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. Now, he's out for up to 8 weeks. Going to miss the start of Liverpool's defence of their title with a knee injury, which he picked up in the Austrian training camp. Last season, of course, got back on track after the season before, which was wiped out by that innocuous injury against Roma in the Champions League in April 2018, collided with Alexander Kolarov, kept him out for over a year. And I just want to talk a little bit about the life of an injured footballer, because it's a dark place, isn't it, for some, Tomo? You know it all too well.
Oh. Yeah, I think
I struggled to recover for many, many years. Obviously, mine was a career-ending injury eventually, but I just couldn't get my head around it. And psychologically, you know, you're going backwards all the time. You only realise how much it's affected you when you look back, maybe 5 years down the line. You altered personality, you know, you become angry, become aggressive, and, you know, it's a really dark and lonely place. I mean, I did have to go and see, obviously, a psychiatrist at times to try and deal with the it's not depression, it's just the really dark negative thoughts, and it's not a nice place to be. So I think any player that's going through that should definitely seek out some help and some guidance on that.
Does it give you extra admiration for someone like Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain for the length of period which he was out and the way he managed to bounce back from that in the last campaign?
Absolutely. But I think one player that stands out particularly for me is Danny Ings. I think, you know, he ruptured one cruciate, he came back, and I think he played about 10 games, and then he ruptured his other cruciate and he was out again for another 10, 12 months. And, you know, that's a similar situation for me. And I was thinking he might struggle to cope, but the way he's come back, he looks like he's come back stronger, he's come back fitter, and, you know, I think he'd have definitely been included in the England squad for the Euros this summer if had it gone ahead.
You know what, I agree with Tomo there. You know, we talk about like sort of visiting teams that came to Anfield last season in terms of individual performances. He was absolutely brilliant for Southampton. I know Liverpool won that game 4-0 in the M4-1, but first half, he really, really put the two centre halves under pressure. Oh, very lively. He looks like, you know, he's playing like you wouldn't guess that he's had the injuries that he's had. Really, really on top of his game. It's great to see because I know how much highly he was regarded by, you know, all the players at Liverpool and the manager as well. Klopp loved him. I just think it is the timing was just so bad. I remember the first injury that he got was the end of the first week of training when Klopp came in. I mean, devastating timing. I mean, he could have, in an alternative world, who knows, he could have become certainly a decent player for Liverpool, plays a fair number of games.
Absolutely. He would have had a great career for us.
What's your thoughts, Si, on the next steps for Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain?
I'm talking about sort of Curtis Jones earlier, nailing a position. I mean, in many ways, I think that's the thing for Oxlade-Chamberlain as well. I mean, it clearly his best position, I think, is in the centre, in midfield. Before he got injured against Roma, I think he was like sort of the driver really throughout that period that got Liverpool into that position. He was outstanding, but I do think when you've had, again, you know, the sort of injury that he's had, it is difficult to get that drive into your play from that position. You know, Klopp wants him to be the one that bursts into the opposition box and takes shots and that sort of, you know, he's a dynamic player. I remember watching him play for Arsenal many years ago, but I think he was still a teenager. I think it was against AC Milan, and he played in the middle of midfield, and I just thought, why isn't Wenger playing in there more often? I guess at the time, you know, he probably thought he was too inexperienced to play there regularly, and it has been a bit of a, you know, it has been a stop-start Liverpool career for him, I guess, you know. I think this is a big year for him. As Tomo says, I mean, it clearly, you know, that's an area, the pitch, where, you know, there could be quite a lot of change over the next few years. You think about James Milner's age, you think about the Wijnaldum uncertainty, you know, Jordan Henderson will be entering, I think he's entering, maybe entered his 30s already, so...
You've got Shaqiri, you know, in there as well.
Shaqiri, you know, I mean, another one we haven't even mentioned. I mean, it's going to be a big ask for him to as Tomo said earlier, when you haven't had that pre-season, you know, he's going to be playing catch-up in 8 weeks' time to get himself fit again. So you're not probably going to see him flying at best until probably October, November time, are you now? So it's going to be, you know, big demands on him. He's going to put I know he puts a lot of pressure on himself. He's desperate to make it work at Liverpool. I know that because after he scored at West Ham, at the start of this year, he scored. I thought he played quite well. He's very critical of his own performance, which is good to see, but I actually thought he was a bit too critical in many ways. You know, there's not many people who, you know, there's a lot of people looking to dig it out in football, and I thought, you know, quite admired him for being so introspective straight after a game, but I thought, you know, he actually has a decent game there. But
when is the forecast he's coming back fit, Simon?
So, well, I mean, they've said anything between 4 to 8 weeks, and, you know, Liverpool, usually in those situations, you know, they're sort of conservative estimates. I mean, you know, so I would be surprised if we saw him play, you know, certainly before October, if, you know, not the middle of October.
I mean, from the outside, he looks like quite an important character within the dressing room. You always see him put forward to do in TV interviews. He seems to be quite happy to be sort of very much almost the promotional vehicle for Liverpool. He seems like a guy that is good behind the scenes. Do you see that, Tomo, as well?
Yeah, I see it. I think he's a great personality. You see him, he's warm and friendly. He's always bubbly. One thing he has got going for him, he's a naturally fit boy. But it just comes back down to the recruitment. I remember when we were signing him, I was a bit sceptical, actually. I was thinking, yeah, he's got ability, he's got explosive power, but he was played out of position a lot for Arsenal. And I always judge players on, you know, especially attacking midfielders, on goals and assists. And for the last three seasons at Arsenal, his goals and assists was really poor. But as soon as he came to Liverpool, you know, he sort of burst out the blocks and he was a powerhouse and he was breaking them lines. He was playing just tucked inside. And, you know, he had a hell of a strike on him and scored important goals for us. And, you know, he really impressed me. A great signing again, another Michael Edwards number. So you've got to give him a lot of credit for that one. As even, you know, signing Shaqiri for, what, 11 million? We'd probably sell Shaqiri now for about 25 million quid.
Right, you're with the Red Agenda, and the economy's getting back underway, and with it the world of sport with Bloomberg and The Athletic. You can stay ahead of the curve with the unparalleled tools of two world-class news desks covering developments across finance, economics, technology and sport. Subscribe to Bloomberg.com, and if you're not already a subscriber to The Athletic, for a limited time you can receive a complimentary Athletic subscription. Go to Bloomberg.com/subscribe and sign up today. So we're on the verge of the Community Shield, Liverpool against Arsenal, Saturday afternoon, 4:30 kickoff. How much does this game matter in terms of adding another trophy to the cabinet? Is that stupid to say, Si?
Yeah, no, I don't think it is. I mean, you know, Liverpool has won the Community Shield last year. You know, they'd been putting that, you know, on the record books, wouldn't they, as another trophy. I mean, if you first and foremost want to see sign of progression and a good performance, I think. You know, I think last season when they played City, it was a bit of a mixed performance, if I remember correctly. You know, poor first half, got stronger the second half, and obviously lost on penalties. I mean, one of the interesting sort of elements really is sort of the opposition, you know, because Arsenal obviously beat Liverpool at the Emirates last, it was only a couple of less than 7-8 weeks ago, and played a very sort of defensive style of football. I mean, I remember the first 20 minutes, I thought Liverpool were going to win about five here. And it was the first time I actually thought, you know, the absence of a crowd is hurting Liverpool a bit here, because I just thought Arsenal would not be able to play that way if there was a crowd there. You know, they'd be willing them on, telling them to get forward a bit more. It's not really the Arsenal sort of way. So it'd be interesting to see how they approach the game as well, really, Arsenal, because I'd imagine, you know, that they're definitely going to be desperate to sort of show signs of progression this season. I know they won the FA Cup and deservedly so, but, you know, they're going to have to be further up the league. So it's going to, you know, not much, there hasn't been much, you know, sort of change between 6 or 7 weeks ago and now, other than Arsenal winning the league. So it'll be interesting to see whether they take confidence from that, and whether they're going to put a bit more pressure on Liverpool this time, because if they sort of line up defensively as he did at the Emirates a few weeks ago, I think it'll give other teams a bit of encouragement if they got a result in those circumstances, because particularly in those away games where, you know, where in normal circumstances the fans are going to be demanding you know the opposition to get forward. If players realise they can't do that, they might be able to do a bit of a number on Liverpool. So it'd be interesting from that perspective, I think. I think Liverpool are going to have to go and show that they can break them down and win the game. I mean, Liverpool really, you know, as I said, to lose that game was a bit of a big disappointment, I felt, because Liverpool are so much stronger than Arsenal. And to make those two terrible mistakes that they made, you know, it was uncharacteristic. So I think they'll want to put that right, knowing the way the players think.
Is it still a big occasion, Tomo, the Community Shield?
It is for me. It's another opportunity to go and win a trophy, and I think that's what it's about. It's about creating good habits, you know, and that winning mentality, and Liverpool have got that at the minute, and they've shown that in the Super Cup, they showed that in the Club Cup. you know, they'll be taking this game seriously. I think just going back to Simon talking about us playing Arsenal last year, I think the league was already in the bag. It was just one of them games, almost like a friendly. And, you know, I think Liverpool didn't want to overexert themselves, really. So it was a strange situation. I wouldn't use that to take into the form book, really, for this game. But Liverpool will be looking to win this game. And I do see them winning it comfortably.
So another big fixture played behind closed doors. I think at one stage they were hoping this might be the game where they could start to try and infiltrate some sort of system of getting a small number of fans in. Interestingly, and yet I think you can tell us a little bit about this, at Radcliffe Borough you played a pre-season game at the weekend and a small number of fans were allowed in, Tomo.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, on that trial basis, we had a couple of hundred fans allowed in, and what a treat it was for them. You know, they witnessed a six-goal thriller. We were 3-0 down at half-time, managed to come back, get it 3-3. We missed a penalty towards the end of the game. We missed a few one-on-ones, but it was a great competitive fixture. It was almost like a final, to be honest with you, the way the game was played. It was, you know, the lads went for a pint up the pub after the game, and there was still quite a few fans hanging around and talking about how much they'd enjoyed the game. So, I mean, I know everybody's missed the football, but it was a bit of a treat for them to come back and watch a game like that.
Mm. We still got no timeline, have we, Si, in terms of getting some fans into stadium? What would your expectations be? I mean, Liverpool fans will be talking about it all the time now.
Mm, we've got no timeline for anything, I think, at the moment, Steve, really. But, I mean, it is encouraging that you know, in non-league football, you know, that there is signs of progression. I know, obviously, Tomo's team was the Betfix in Northern Premier League, isn't it now? So,
I'm glad you said that, Si, because I wasn't sure there.
it's a Northern Premier League, so it's the third tier in non-league football and down. I think between now and the end of the month, each club can host games with, I think, gates of no more than 200 or 300, and then it can go up to something like 40% of the capacity, 30-40% of the capacity from next month. I think non-league football is safe in that sense, because most clubs at that level won't be getting gates higher than that. You know, there's obviously a lot of empty space, but it'll be interesting to see whether, because people aren't able to attend matches at the Premier League level, well, whether people will be more determined to go and watch non-league football as a consequence. But I've noticed a lot of non-league clubs are selling tickets online now, so they can obviously regulate who comes in and who goes out. In terms of the Premier League, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about how to do it. I know a lot of the Premier League clubs are looking at way, you know, sort of technology, you know, to ensure that, you know, sort of they're looking at, you know, to scan people as they come in and out the grounds. But you know, I've heard anything from 20% capacity from October, November to 70% capacity next year. But you know, nothing's been confirmed yet. I think because we're still in sort of uncharted territory and still trying to figure out what our limitations are as a society, I think it's difficult to make those estimates at the moment. But clearly, it's going to have to be a solution that the Premier League clubs and all football clubs find in the end, because, you know, football clubs still need that revenue from the spectators attending the ground, particularly, you know, outside the Premier League, particularly outside the Championship. You know, and I think clubs are absolutely desperate to, you know, League One and League Two to get fans back in. So the sooner they sort of find some solutions, you know, the better. Really.
Simon, I'm looking at it, and I think, you know, if you look at some of the revenue to turnover in the Championship, I'm just wondering how many of these clubs are actually going to survive, because if they don't let the fans in soon, I mean, if you look at Man United, they're really struggling. They're losing £5 million a week, but yet they're a club that's a very wealthy club. Liverpool losing about £4 million every game. But if you look at the repercussions that are going into the Championship and League One, it's really disturbing. So I think the sooner the better we allow fans to get back into the stadium, and to, you know, they can regulate their own risk. If they're showing symptoms, then stay at home. You know, we can take temperatures on the way in. You've got the hand sanitizer. You know, it's you can take your face mask in as well. And but I think it's going to be a necessity, because this situation is really, really bad for football, and I don't think we're only going to realise the implications until 6-7 months down the line.
Let's finish with a word on today's pod about undoubtedly one of the greatest players Liverpool's ever seen, yet his legacy has been tainted by his managerial reign and his eagerness to enforce change at the club in the early 90s, and also a newspaper interview which he openly admits he regrets. We're talking about Graeme Souness. Si wrote an article on him recently. He's intriguing. I mean, for me, he's in my top three greatest Liverpool players. He demonstrates everything you want out of a player, but he's done things wrong, which he admits. And that word tainted, it's probably correct, isn't it? You spoke with him, Si?
That's sort of why I decided to write the article, really, because after Liverpool won the league, obviously there were a lot of people being interviewed on Sky, and you know, you could see just how satisfied he was. I mean, he loves Liverpool, you know, he really does. I mean, I've met him a few times, and I've got to admit, like the first time I met him, I was nervous. I don't tend to be that nervous. I was probably didn't have quite as much experience at that point in my life. I was a bit younger, but he has this aura about him. But he was such a, you know, so warm and friendly, and tried to help me as much as he could, and was as honest about his own shortcomings as anybody ever has been in an interview with me. And interviewed him several times since, you know, in one of the books that Tomo featured in as well. And you know, I just thought it was worth writing about. You know, is it time that Liverpool fans sort of forgive and forget? And I think I sense that there has been a sort of a softening of attitude towards him, you know, off the back of what happened when he was manager. I mean, the newspaper interview that you mentioned, that's the thing that really some people will understandably, I think, not be able to get over. But I do sense that there's a growing acceptance and a growing sort of willingness to welcome him back in again, because I found, you know, I was part of this process where some of the Liverpool Merseyside supporters group wanted him involved in like a end of season chat, and he did Zoom chats with them and answered some difficult questions in that interview as well. So I think that's great. I mean, I didn't see him play, but I always remember when I was growing up, my dad was for him, it was Souness over Dalglish every day of the week. He just absolutely loved Graeme Souness. So when he became Liverpool manager, I was dead excited, and I remember saying to my dad, oh, you know, they're going to be all right, aren't they? And my dad was like, yeah. And never listened to my dad again about football after that. No, it wasn't all bad. There were some good things that he did as manager as well. I think, obviously, you know, sort of his record bringing in some of the younger players was important, but it's such a shame, really, and it's something that he regrets massively. It was one of the reasons why I wanted Tomo to come in, because I know how obviously, you know, you played for him at Blackburn and how much, you know, you respected him. I remember you told me a great story about when, you know, there was a bit of a ruckus in the changing room and you sorted it all out. Do you remember that one, Tomo?
Man marshalled everyone. We got into a big fight and, you know, we were 2-0 down at the time, and, you know, the fight went on for about 15 minutes at half time, and then we were absolutely exhausted. Every one of us went, but we went out and we got back into the game. And then on the Monday morning, the gaffer pulled me in the office. I thought, it's definitely 2 weeks' wages here. But he gave me a bottle of 400 quid wine and two nice, lovely glasses for me and the missus. And he said, you know, make sure you decant that wine. And I said, what for? Because I didn't drink wine, I was on Stella. You know, it's like he's trying to educate me. And obviously, that's where the champagne Charlie, he lived up to his name there. But I think he's a really emotional guy. I could see how happy and satisfied he was when Liverpool, and how passionate he is about Liverpool. I mean, that one big regret he's got is he did that interview. But I mean, if you, in his defence, you know, he had a triple heart bypass, and I don't think he was in his right frame of mind. I think if in hindsight, he would never ever do that, and he would never intentionally upset Liverpool fans, because I know he loves the club. But just in terms of another story, you know, we're calling them Big Time Charlie and Champagne Charlie. It was we were playing one game before the game at Blackburn, and he came in with a picture of him lifting the European Cup, and I was stood next to Andy Cole, and he said, "Do you know what, Coley?" He went, "I'm not sure if that's the first European Cup or the third one that I lifted," and he just killed, the two of us there. And then, you know what I mean? It was like, yeah, oh my God, it was absolute. But in terms of, yeah, I've got a lot of respect for the man. I admired him as a manager. I've seen all the video footage of him as a player. He was a magnificent footballer, and just as a person and a friend, I think he's a great man. And it would be lovely if the Liverpool fans could forgive him for that one mishap. And and obviously signing Julian Dix as well.
we could go on. Tomo, it's been a delight to have you on today. Thanks for holding it together in midfield. and the best of luck with the season as well, and the managerial ambitions. Just a quick line, what are your managerial ambitions?
Obviously, I'm there as assistant manager at the moment to assist Lee in any way that I can to try to improve the team and improve the performance levels. But I am enrolled to do my pro licence. Not got a date on that yet, but I'm hoping it's going to be within the next 9 to 12 months. You know, there's obviously been a backlog with that, and then try to get a job in league football. But I'm cutting my teeth in non-league at the minute, and it's been a great experience. I've loved it that Lee's given me the opportunity to go and demonstrate that I can coach and also can assist in non-league football. I mean, sometimes I don't actually recognise the football, but it's been really interesting and really eye-opener, but one that I'm absolutely enjoying.
Tomo, best of luck, and thank you very much indeed.
Cheers, boys. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
That's David Thompson. And Si as well. Thank you. Loads of stuff on the site, which Si has written. Catch up with that on theathletic.com. Simon, thank you. Another Red Agenda. We'll be back next week.